who I am. One of the neatest things in this convention is that I have learned that I can patch my iPad into the projections screen here. And I can even do this. I'm going to share with you a photo that I found too late to put into my book on Jack. I found yours here. This is Steve Sherman, who's sitting over there. Steve Sherman, ladies and gentlemen. And myself. And I think this may have been Jasper Vinehouse. Roz, I'm sure, took this photo. And this was in the Lisa Kirby gave me every photo she could find of Jack. I prowled through them, and somehow I missed this one the first time through and found it. I was reorganizing the photos to give back to her after the book went to press. And I think I'm 17 in this.
Probably, yeah, I think I'm probably 19.
Yeah. Natural habitat at the drawing table. We do these panels every year, you know, because I spend an awful lot of my time at this convention talking about Jack. I'm sure I'm not the only one. And you walk around that room downstairs and you see his influence everywhere. Even, and I don't mean just that you see a lot of Galactus masks or Thor merchandise or Captain America memorabilia. What you see is Jack's definition of comics, which transcended those things printed on cheap newsprint. You see that definition of comics all over the room. And the oddest things remind me of him. I suddenly see somebody. There were people downstairs doing this science fiction-y dance last night. Don't you just love the fact that nobody in a costume seems to be able to take a picture anywhere except right where you want to walk in the audience. But they're doing this like science fiction. And remember, do you remember how Jack had this idea about dance as a comics as dance?
Right.
Yeah. And I thought, we kind of like shrugged and thought, okay, yeah, that doesn't make a lot of sense, but some of the things Jack said didn't make a lot of sense at that moment. And there's comics as dance. They do an interpretive ballet in the aisles of the comic convention, and it is comics somehow on a strange level. So we're going to talk about Jack for a while. I'm going to start by asking everybody in the audience who has a Kirby-related announcement about something that they're publishing or producing to offer. Let me introduce to you the dais at this moment. On the far side is one of my favorite collaborators, and Adam has become an amazing artist in this business with his comic, The Savage Dragon. This is Mr. Eric Larson. And I've known this next gentleman for an awful long time, and I asked him to come here. One of the themes of the convention this year is 50 years of comic fandom. Richard here was a pioneer of comic fandom. There are some who credit him for being the first person to use the term graphic story in an article about comics. And in the early 70s, he had a bookstore in Long Beach, which was the center of intelligentsia in Southern California for people who understood what comics could be imported for in comics, one of the first people to do that. And he went to any kind of the store, there were great writers and artists hanging around and talking. It was like a Just to go there was like a mini comic convention, but with really smart people. This is Mr. Richard Kyle. I asked Richard to relate the story of the project he did with Jack that you've all been familiar with. I'm the person I know even longer than I know Richard, and who was another one of those people who often was found hanging around the store. Mr. Mike Royer, ladies and gentlemen. Another artist who I think that I admire tremendously, maybe you've seen a brand new book that he's reprinting his store work off the original art in Is it the exact same size you did it? It's the exact same size it was done. This is your wall signs. He's going to be rushing here from another meeting, so he will probably be late. He may not get here before the panel ends. But I asked British TV personality and devout comic fan Jonathan Ross to join us, and he says he will. And we'll talk about stuff until he gets here, so he gets here. Let me take this off the screen. Oh, we should have one more photo here. I'll show you a couple more photos here. Oh, I got this thing hooked up here. If I can remember how to do this. Here's one with Joe Simon.
One was when I called him from the booth, and
So that was and in that same phone call, I said, we had made some arrangements through Paramount, and the night before I called him, Joe saw the movie. And he loves it. He said, and that just made my convention. After all that, after those two moments, I'm sort of like, you know, okay, the rest of it's going to be fun, but what the heck. So come on by the tiny booth if you'd like. I know we still have a few more of these, and they're signed by Joe. It's interesting because they've got a book plate in them, but I was there when we printed the book plate out in Joe's studio, so that's kind of fun. And we've got some other stuff there, but most of all, just come on by and say hey, because working with Joe is such a privilege. I just love to talk about it. So thanks a lot.
Should point out that all of us who had the pleasure of working with Jack in essence became family.
This is true on a very wide level. I never felt that I worked for Jack. I felt like I was kind of semi-adopted, like everyone who came here, Jack. Even for a short period of time, one of the amazing things about him was that he treated everybody like family. Even somebody you met at the convention for 10 seconds. You were entitled to, you were part of his world until you proved undeserving to be there. Yes?
I'd like to expound on that for a minute. The first Comic Con I went to was in 1975 at the El Cortez, and there was no security, and Jack and Ross were wonderful, and you know, they would walk to the coffee shop down the street, trailed by a bunch of kids just picking at Jack's brain and stuff while he's eating. And, you know, he was just so gracious. And I've got your book. It's wonderful. And the thing that I got mostly is just he had this great work ethic. He just wanted to support his kids. There was no ego involved. And I've met him probably 3 or 4 times at different conventions here. And he was always wonderful. And I think this room should be packed, and it should be in a larger room.
All right. Well, we're packed in a larger room. I remember one time, Jack, I was standing next to Jack at a convention, but when Roz had to go to use the ladies' room, she turned to me and said, "Here, stand next to me, say no to everybody." And I came up. very earnest, very nice, and he said to Jack, "You are my favorite comic book artist of all time, after Neil Kane, of course." There was not a Jack, he did not flinch, he did not look like he just been slapped in the face. He was completely appreciative of that. He was, and he said, "Yeah, he was great, isn't Bill terrific?" No ego. It was not an act, I'm sure. You know, I have people come up to me all the time and they go, "Oh, your work is almost as good as these other five people."
Yes.
And I go, "Oh yeah, those five people are really good at what they are." And he was completely without, he did not feel he was in competition with other people in comics, and that was not a matter of ego when he was above them. He just felt that he was doing his own, I hate the term doing your own thing, he was working his own arena on his own material, he was competing with no one but himself. And
trying to do the best he can?
Yeah, that's right. And he was so happy with the success of younger people. He didn't feel threatened by new people getting into the business. He encouraged every single new person who came to him, including some I think he should have done us a favor by discouraging. Let me introduce our new panelist. When I told, mentioned on my blog that I was getting Jonathan Ross on here, several of my readers in the UK acted like I had gotten the Beatles together again. This man hosts TV shows over there. I host panels here. I hope he is paid. And he's the star of a show which is on YouTube all the time if you can't get those shows, called The Penn Teller Fools, which I think is one of the greatest shows I've. And we don't care about that. We care about that. He's a devout comic fan. This is Jonathan Ross.
I apologize for being late. I was sat behind people with capes outside the Omnia, which isn't a bad place to be. But I guess Mark invited me here because he knows just what a devoted Kirby fan I am and always have been. I thought it'd be my son, who's here as well. His middle name is Kirby. I named him after the great name Harvey Kirby Ross. I wanted him to be Wolf Cthulhu Kirby Galactus Ross. That's what I want to be. He's furious now. Now he's 17. He tells everyone, "That's what my name was going to be." But he's so proud his name is Kirby. And even though, like most kids, he loves comics, but he's kind of equally excited about video games and stuff like that. But certainly, he loves and admires Jack's work, and he feels very honoured to have borrowed your family name. So thank you for the love. And I also have, I don't know whether we're talking about it, but I also have a huge collection of Kirby artwork I'm lucky enough to have. I've spent far too much money and always lied to my wife about exactly how much Kirby work, which I'll gladly bring over sometime if you want me to bring some open display.
Sure.
Have some quite rare pieces, and I always have the guys from the Kirby collector scan it all. There's one thing I might just say, you know, I made a documentary called In Search of Steve Ditko. I don't know if anyone saw that. Prior to that, many, many years ago, and before I had the kind of clout on TV that I had in that period to get that off the ground, and one of the determining factors, in fact, of them allowing me to make that was the fact they knew that Steve Ditko was alive, of course, and I had suggested a Jack Kirby thing, but because they knew there was no chance of us speaking to Jack for a mainstream TV channel, that seemed to be an issue. But many, many years ago, when I first started TV, I tried for about 3 years to get various people interested in making the Jack Kirby documentary. I went to even Melvin Bragg, who you might know is Lord Melvin Bragg in the UK. He was in charge of a very popular arts magazine show for years called The South Bank Show. You've probably seen some of them over here, PBS, mm-hmm. I'm sure.
Yes.
And I kind of got quite close to him committing to doing a Kirby documentary. And in the end, they pulled it because, of course, they said at the time, no one's going to watch a show about comics on TV. And they couldn't see the bigger picture. They couldn't see what Jack had created and what he meant to so many people and just what an influence he has been on not just American popular culture, but globally on popular culture. So that was always, that's probably my, and I've had a lot of, I've had a very interesting, wacky rollercoaster career, as some of you may know, but that's probably my only actual regret, is that I never got to persuade anyone to finance that Jack Kirby documentary.
Wow. What was the reaction like to that documentary? What kind of response did you get?
It was pretty positive. I mean, it's on BBC Four, which is one of the minority BBC channels, which I think they're thinking of shutting down, which is a shame, because they do so much great stuff. Interestingly, some people, some devout Stan Lee fans came to me and they were angry at the way I grilled Stan about not sharing, in my opinion, never sharing the love, never sharing the credits properly with Steve and Jack for that period there. You know, and we had a fairly frank conversation on camera, I know you've seen it, in which I respect Stan a lot. I think Stan is a great talent, there's no choice about it, but I do think that he achieved his status on the shoulders of greater talents, to be quite frank. In particular, Jack specifically, but also Steve and maybe some of the other guys from that period there. And I still think it's a shame that for whatever reasons he can't see that how many of us see that. But I wouldn't take away from his contribution because it's, you know, it's massive and magnificent. And those books are great because they were Jack and Stan together. And Steve and Stan together, and that's the way I always think of them. They were Jack and Stan, and Steve and Stan, not the other way around, despite the way he chose to work it on the pages. So that was probably the only kind of, not so much negative, but kind of critical feedback we got from that. But over and above that, some people thought we shouldn't have gone and knocked on Steve's door, because he's made it clear to us that he didn't want to speak to us, but I just couldn't resist, I'm afraid. And he was, you know, he was very charming and sweet with us, and he told me some interesting things about Spider-Man, but that I think I've shared maybe with you and some other people, but this probably isn't the place. I don't want to take up time talking about Steve when we're here to talk about Jack.
You can talk a little about Steve.
Okay, well,
anybody in this room is interested and a fan of Steve.
I think he's one of the best thinkers in that early period of Marvel that Jack ever had. I think
we were at Bob Kane's funeral, as I tell this story elsewhere. There were four people there who were in the comic business. It was myself, Stan Lee, Mike Barr, and Paul Smith. And Kane's family treated us like, oh, the comic book industry has sent its emissaries. We were the delegates the industry had voted. We just all came on our own. And we're standing there in this very long period of lowering Mr. Kane into the ground. The elevators weren't working right on the thing. And I'm standing there waiting, and suddenly Stanley, so helpful, turns to me and he says, you know, Steve Ditko was the best anchor Jack ever had. Did I miss something? I was starting to talk about that. And Jack, he said, and I think Ditko was probably, I think Jack, Stan enjoyed, he recognized Jack was the greater contributor because Jack did more books and it was all the little characters. But I think he personally enjoyed his collaborations with Ditko more because he felt more like there was a give and take between them, whereas Jack would just say, okay, fine, go home with it. And he loved Ditko's artwork, he loved Ditko's inking, and he kept saying, I wish that I'd had two Steve Ditkos, one of them just named Jack all the time, but I couldn't spare Ditko for that.
Did Jack think his own work much?
Not very much. He didn't like inking stuff. Roz inked a few things, assisting him. I think it's over-exaggerated with Roz inking, put on that. She inked. What he would do with that is when he had to ink something, Roz had it. When Jack met Roz, she was working in fashion layout design and doing art. She was very handy with a pen at doing little patterns and such. And he would give her the pages after they were penciled and lettered and give her a static pen, a pen that just had to put out a very static line. And she would outline everything. And he would take a brush and would heavy up the lines. And I think he obliterated about 85% of what she did going over it. But it helped him I think what it did is it stopped him from redrawing everything when he ended it. But any line that isn't a static line on that page is Jack. And a brush and heavying things up and putting in black areas and shadows.
It's a shame you didn't go back and do that other Vince Cavendish.
Let's try to show that for the fourth time in our panel this convention, somebody else has trashed Vince Coletta without me prompting.
His covers weren't too bad. He was obviously getting paid more on the covers. The covers he put a little bit of work in, but the interior stuff. I mean, I've got so many pages of Jack stuff in my Vince where you almost cry when you see how much it's just been erased.
Exactly.
It's been loved to have you.
But a lot of the earlier inkers would do that. There was a lot of the early Joe Simon stuff would have the static line around it to begin with. And looking at the original art, it's interesting to see that's the process that a lot of inkers would go through. They would start with the static line around it. Because these days, generally, if you're outlining something, you start with a brush, and then you're coming in and putting the details in with a pen. And that was the exact opposite of how things were being done there, where they would outline everything with a pen and get that dead line going, and then come in with a brush afterward and add all the neat to it.
But it's interesting, you know, of all the artists we know, the one artist whose work survived no matter who inked it would be Jack. Because there was something about the energy and the kind of composition and the kind of directness of that work, as well as the complexity of some of the concepts on the page, that he didn't kind of matter. You know, even the most, I mean, you know, you look at the very early books, like, I don't know, who inked FF3? Was that
Sol Brodsky?
Sol Brodsky, you know, and some of it's not too bad, but some of it's just awful, just awfully. I mean, still the book is a beautiful thing and a powerful experience to read because the art was just so great.
It always surprised me when I first met Jack that he didn't care that much about doing it. And I think to a certain extent he felt it was like an insult to tell him that his work needed a certain anchor. He thought the story was all there. He said no professional anchor ever ruined a comic. And I think later on he moved away from that because he had so many fans who visited and tell him, oh, I really like it better when it's Joe Sinnott. I really like it better when it's Frank G. Boyer, etc.
Mike Royer.
At some point, then it became Mike Royer. John, have you met all the people on the panel? You know,
I think I've met everyone. Yes, I have met everyone. We have met, haven't we? Yes.
Yes,
of course. Oh my God, no, I've never met Mike Royer. I can't believe I've just touched Mike Royer's hand. I'm that much closer.
And you saw it here.
Okay, and Mike has always been, I'm not just saying this, but Mike has always been my favorite Kirby inker. Always. You didn't want to ink all those books in the Fourth World period when they were coming your way, and Jeff was saying, I've got another one for you, and another one for you, another one. I'm so glad he bullied you into it, because I love that stuff.
It's really funny. I guess I'm the only inker that really kept up with his output. And I kind of evolved this theory just talking to some fans yesterday, is that when Jack and I would talk about old movies, we both loved the Warner Brothers films from the 30s and 40s. He luckily saw them firsthand. I had to wait till TCM. But people ask me who my favorite inker on Jack was, and I'll say Joe Sinnott, who was, I think, the most faithful to him. I would say me, because I inked Jack Kirby's Warner Brothers drawings as a Warner Brothers inker, and Joe Sinnott was MGM.
Yes. You know, I have it. It's interesting to compare. I wish I had a picture to show them, but I have some of the work that much of the work you've done. I have a beautiful book, which is just not just one of the most beautiful examples of Kirby art ever, but also I think the best example, one of the best examples of your inking, which is I'm lucky enough to have all of Commandy Book 6. The cover I threw, which was The Death of Flower, and about a third of the way through, there's a beautiful lush landscape scene shot from above down into a valley, and the trees and the rocks. I mean, Eric, you have a whole Commandy Book as well. Yeah, we
shot. I've got a sick amount of life, Jack Kirby.
Like two young men in the restroom comparing the size.
Thanks for coming. I'm out of here. Thanks a lot. I'm done.
You've seen it all before. But I also have a page of Orion versus Darkseid, which was inked by Joe Sinnott. And it's fascinating to see Sinnott's inks on Fourth World pencils as well. Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. It doesn't work as well to my eye, but it's a lovely thing to see.
And when you just talk about that, I was thinking of comparing, like, well, you know, the artwork used to be bigger.
I've got one. This is not quite related, but it's about Joe. It's about Jack and Joe. Which is, I just wonder if this story is true. You would know it. Steve would know it because I've heard this story. I've told it a million times. It was a fabulous story. But this is from back, I presume, in the 40s and the Schaff days. The idea was where Joe Simon apparently told Jack he wasn't being paid to a race. Have you heard this story?
Yes.
Is that true?
I believe it is true.
Awesome. Could you tell them the story? That's just a great story.
I think you just told it to them.
Well, I didn't set it up.
The second call was that Jack had drawn a page and he decided he didn't like it and he started erasing on it.
Okay.
Which he did a lot. He would draw pages over and over to please himself. They were perfectly fine by anybody else's standards. And Joe walked in and said, "What the hell are you doing?" And Jack said, "Oh, I can do this better." Joe wanted Jack to do as many pages as possible. He said, "Jack, you're not being paid to erase this. You're being paid to draw it."
I just thought that was great.
And one time we were with Jack, he was drawing a picture of Jimmy Olsen, and there was a pose where Superman was flying out of the audience in a pose that you'd have all recognized. It was a pose that Jack used over and over again, the character kind of flying straight at you, his hands up. And I said, "Oh, you're using that." I just being a snotty kid who said, occasionally said things I shouldn't have said. I said, "Oh, you're using that pose again." And Jack went, "What?" And I said, "You do that." He grabbed it and started erasing that panel. And it was perfectly fine. I wasn't saying don't do it. I was just kind of, I was trying to show off that I recognized he would be using something like that. And he did that immediately. And it was not, this was during the period of Jimmy Olsen, when he knew that they were going to be redrawing Superman. He was redrawing something that he knew that Murphy Anderson was going to redraw.
Or Al Plastino.
This is after Al Plastino days. But he put maximum effort into every single thing he did as executively possible. You've had a question for him.
How did he feel about Murphy Anderson and Al Plastino doing that? And do any of the original drawings of Superman with his face and his chest emblem exist? I would love to see that.
Well, let me tell you, I was going to answer this in the Kirby Collector. Let me tell you a story here that I've never gotten quite right. People understand this. Jack sent in, the order that Jack did his work for DC, you can figure out by looking at those little X numbers on the page, and I think John has printed a guideline, but it's very close to the order he did them in. If those are the billing numbers, that's for what he was paid for them, which is almost identical to the order he did them in. There might be one item variance occasionally, I believe the very first thing he did for DC was a couple of covers for Forever People and New Gods and Mr. Miracle. He did the first issue of Forever People and the first issue of New Gods and the first issue of Mr. Miracle. And then he went over and started drawing Jimmy Olsen issues. These are months and months before these books went to press. They came in, DC quietly, without showing them to their other editors in the office, they didn't want to secure the lead. They gave them to John Costanza a letter, and John brought them back. They were hidden from the other editors. And then they went off to Vince Coletta at Inc. When Steve Sherman and I went up to the DC offices in July of 1970 for the first time, and remember that the first Forever People didn't go on sale until December, so we were way ahead of press date. Julia Schwartz sat us down. Remember this, Steve? Julia Schwartz sat us down and said, "What is this Forever People New Gods thing that's going on? Tell me about it." Now, his office was about 8 yards from Carmine's. And the word was passing by. They wouldn't even show it to Julie Schwartz in the office, who was their senior editor. And so, by the way, if anybody tells you that everything Vince Coletta ever did was rushed and done at the last minute, he had 6 months to do those books. They did the first issues of Forever People had Superman in it. Some people there at DC looked at it and said, "This is not quite right. Vinny, could you try to fix it when you do the ink?"
Oh, God.
And some people in the office and the production staff had gone over some of the pencils and they had modified the work. They had tried to do the Superman emblem over on the pencil stage and made some corrections. And Vinny did more. Mr. Coletta, I happen to think he gets a bum rap an awful lot, but he was asked, I think he was frequently asked to do stuff that was above his pay grade. And he came back with Superman and more people in the office worked it over, and it was a committee created Superman, and finally when the books are all done, they looked at it and said, "No, we ruined it." There is some place out there, because I've seen it, a set of stats of the book before Al Plastino got to it, and it's not Jack either. It was inked by Vinny, and it was reworked, so there's a couple of Kurt Swan heads in it that I think someone in the office swiped and tried to change. And they looked at it, they said, "This is not really working for us. We can't send it out this way." I think there was a feeling they couldn't at that point go back to Jack and ask him to re-pencil those things because, you know, this was 1970 DC. The office didn't make mistakes, only the freelancers did. And so they brought Al Plastino in. Now, this is weird irony of this. It's like, here's 1970, we're going to try to bring forth a new Superman. We want Jack Kirby to help us show how to bring Superman into a new era. Oops, let's get the guy who's been drawing Superman from 1946 to redraw it, an artist who we fired off the comics because we think his work looks old-fashioned. You didn't see Al Plastino drawing Superman at that time.
No.
But he was cheap, and he was a guy who was around, and he wanted to give him some work, and he redrew and he repasted over on Forever People number one and on the first two Jimmy Olsons. At that point, he had them all at the same time, he did them all at the same day, brought them back, and that's what was printed there. Subsequently, they would tell Vinny, "Leave the Superman heads and Jimmy Olsen heads, and we'll have them in the office." And Murphy Anderson was the guy in the office. He was the only person on. He was not on staff. He just freelance work in the office. And every time the voter would say, "Here, you know, Murphy, we need this cover retouched." If a retouch came in that was above the pay grade of the office staff, they could give it to Murphy. And
And Murphy's retouches turned up in Lois Lane at that time, and a few other books as well. So that's how it came about. It was this committee phase process, and they redid it.
Well, I'd like to add, Mark, that when I finally got to ink some of the Jimmy Olsons, I don't know who I spoke to, Jack or you or Steve or somebody, but I said, look, I can fix those S's. I can tweak the Superman and the Jimmy Olsen faces, and at least it'll all be inked from the same hand. So the Olsons that I worked on, I made those corrections. If correction is the right word. Jack was an impressionist, and he gave his impression of the S, and it was his Superman. But I felt if I made the changes, at least there would be a consistency in the finished look.
And I even think that if those books had been inked in the first place by Wally Wood, who wanted to ink them, or they'd been inked by Frank Giacoya, who wanted to ink them, they would have gone through fine with Jack's work on it.
Do you know, Mark, how did it come about that Adams did some of the inking on some of the covers there for Jimmy Olsen?
Because Neil just grabbed, he said, let me save these. Neil was a very powerful force in the DC offices at that time. He had no official title. But he would come up there and do retouches occasionally, or he was like the artistic conscience. A lot of why DC Comics of 1970 and 71 around that period look so good is Neil Adams. They also look good because Carmine, whatever else I think of him, he was a great designer.
Yes,
he was
a brilliantly
talented artist, and when he was at his full ability to apply himself, he wasn't running around looking at sales figures all day. He was a very bright, clever designer who knew how to bring in a lot of wonderful new talent into those books, too.
Now, this is a bit about Carmine, if I might. I know it's Jack, but about the design element of Carmine. There was what was the zine that DC put out? The Wonderful World of DC Comics, something like
Amazing
that?
World of DC.
Amazing World of DC Comics. One of those has a cover, and it's got all the Carmine's villains. They're all sitting around a table, and they're talking. It's that book there. But they're also, there's an ink version trying to go. They're all sitting around a table, like the Captain Cold and different villains and so on. They're all, Grodd the Gorilla, and they're all saying, it was up at Continuity, which was Neil Adams, Dick DeJohnette Studio. I was there one day. It was a clubhouse for all of us young guys in comics at the time, in the early 70s. They had that cover, and some of the other young guys, some of the gophers and stuff in the office, were kind of making fun of it because it was Carmine. And, it wasn't Neil, it wasn't Jack, or whatever it was. They're making fun of it. On the back of the cover, or somewhere in the magazine, they had Carmine's rough of the drawing, which was his rough sketch and the stuff. And Neil said, no, you guys are wrong. He says, look at this. And he pulls out the rough, and he shows it, and he shows the negative space of the table, with everybody's elbows on it, and their hands, and their poses to it, and the entire negative shape of the table, which is this very irregular white shape in the center of the drawing, completely holds the drawing locked into place. And you could see Carmine's design as clearly as if he'd said the arrows and said, design, design, here. It made a beautiful drawing, a beautiful piece of work. It was less visible in the inks, which I think somebody else had done. But it was clearly, Mark said, one of Carmine's best talents was he was spectacular at drawing and designing stuff with shapes. He was a phenomenal shape artist. I'm sorry, I just sneaked that in.
But, not exactly relevant, but let's stick it there anyway. This was the third year of the Comic Con. We're sitting out the fourth year at the Harbor Island Hotel. Yeah. We're in Harbor Island. Neil Adams is sitting by the pool doing sketches for fans. And kids are throwing questions out about comics as he's drawing stuff. And one kid says, why do they allow crappy artists like Don Heck in comics? There was a pause, and Neil turned to him and said, you know, if they had put me on those books with those inkers and jerked me around like that, you'd be sitting here right now asking Don Head by the crappy artist like Neil Adams in comics. When Steve and I went to the DC office, I delivered Alex Post's original art for Hot Wheels number 5, a famous story that was there. And Saul Harrison looked at it and went, we got to change this. We got to get all the black out from between the panels. And Neil came in and talked them out of it. Now, Neil did not get credit for this. Neil saved an awful lot of DC Comics over the years. And the reason he inked those covers.
Is that the Cord story?
The Cord story, yes.
Oh, my God.
There was a man on staff at DC named Sal Amendola, who some of you know. And they had given Sal this story and said,
take the black out. We don't do that at DC. We don't put black between the panels. Take them out. And Sal came to me and he said, I don't know what to do about this. I don't want to deface this. And we talked for a few minutes. He came up here and he said, I'm going to stall till Neil gets here. He went in and showed it to Neil, and Neil went, hold on. He took the art to Sal Harris's office and came out 10 minutes later and said, don't take the black out.
You've mentioned two people, Carmine and Alex, and I have these memories that just are etched in my brain. And one evening, sitting on the floor at Alex Toth's with Carmine, and just sitting there and listening to these guys talk about their experiences and design and so on, and I asked Carmine, because I'm 20-something and just in the business, and said, exactly how do they color these comics? And he said, it's magic, kid.
I also remember, and Mike may have repressed this memory, that same trip to 1970, Mike was back with us. We shared, Mike, Steve, and I shared a hotel room about the size of this table.
At the Statler Hilton.
At the Statler Hilton, which I've stayed at recently, has not been cleaned since. and Mike was taking up samples to maybe get the job of making some of Jack's stuff for D.C., and he took it up to the D.C. offices, and there was this editorial gangbang of tearing it down and said, this man is not good enough to work for us. And it was clearly not the work. It was clearly the fact that they didn't want Jack to have his own anchor in L.A., have that control. And they didn't like, and that was at that time in D.C., it was kind of a very snotty attitude. If you're not already working for us, you must not be very good. You know, I had a very memorable art exchange one time with a man named Saul Harrison, the production head. Where he actually said to me, he was talking about how crappy old art in Marvel Comics was. And I said, well, do you think John Buscema and Gene Colan are bad? Yeah, well, we wouldn't take that work at DC. And then I said, because I said, well, Gil Kane's working for both companies. Are you telling me that the Gil Kane art for DC is excellent art and the Gil Kane art for Marvel is crappy art? And he said, it's exactly what I'm telling you. His quote was, Gil knows he can't get away with having that shit into us. So that was the mentality. So Mike's work was belittled. It's like Carmine was calling other people into the office and saying, tell us why we don't like this. Tell us why this is it. And then after he left the office, feeling very dejected, all those people kept coming up to Mike and telling him, we really like what you did a lot.
Well, it's funny. When Jack left Marvel, we met by me inking stuff for him from Marvel Mania. I mean, this memorable phone call. Mike Ryer, this is Jack Kirby. Alex Toth says you're a pretty good inker. And I went to his house the next day. I thought I would take the work home. And he says, just sit here at the board and do it. Like, good. And, you know, every few minutes he'd come and look over my shoulder. Talk about intimidation. But it's like, but all of a sudden I was family, you know, having sandwiches made by Roz. Anyway, of course, he came back from New York and he said, well, I always wanted you along, but it didn't work out that way. So when I went back with Mark and Steve to New York, I walk into Carmine's office and I go, I can do a better job than Vince Coletta's doing. And at lunch, Dick Giordano says, you better be careful, Mike. You're getting a reputation for being cocky.
Dick was one of the guys who sought you out the hallway afterwards and said he liked what you did.
What was that?
Dick was one of the people who came up to you afterwards after that meeting when they were tearing the work apart and said, I really, really like what you did. And it was a very wonderful sound. Now, we're talking here about inkers ruining Jack's work, changing it, whatever. One of the few things late in his career that Jack did that came out exactly the way he intended it, because it wasn't ink, was a story called Street Code. We have on the dais the publisher of that magazine, Richard Kyle. Through the convention wearing dark glasses the other day, and someone came up to you and said, Stan Lee, can I have your autograph?
Is that your sunglasses? Yes, it's true, and I'm wearing the sunglasses, but I don't know whether it'll work here, but let's just give it a try. Now, this is me before I become Stan Lee.
Well done.
At Excelsior.
how Street Code came to be. Would you get a little closer to the microphone? I'll pull it closer to you.
I will with your help, because I'm a person that has never remembered a date in my life, and so I don't know what the year was. I think it was 82, maybe, when...
I think a little before that, but not much before that.
Well, 81?
Yeah, I think it was about 1980.
Oh, okay. In 1980, at the Communist Convention, I got an IFOD award that I didn't expect at all, and it really surprised me. And... So I had talked it over with a couple of people. I think conceivably I mentioned it to Mike, that Jack's pencils were really extraordinary. In the early days, however, you couldn't shoot from them. The printing processes at that time just didn't really allow for good reproduction. The offset, the reproduction that they, I think they have now, wasn't there. And Mike had also told me that Jack started his career drawing twice up, that is twice the size of the printed page, and he felt, and I think once he said it, I started examining it closely. He thought that something had been lost because Jack was continuing to draw twice up, but he was putting them on 1.5 time up pages. And when but I never could quite catch it because I could see that there was some similarity. But then DC came out with the digest sized books, and you can really see it on the digest sized books. There was another artist, not Mike, who was working it, and he tended to oversimplify his line. And so, it really, the digest size, what's the war book that he did?
Losers.
Losers.
The Losers. You can see it in the digest versions of the Losers, and it really looks remarkable. It in some ways, is better as art, despite the reduction, than some of the stuff that Jack was doing at the time, because I don't think that he ever quite made the transition from 1.5 to 2. But anyway, I was...
Richard, let me interrupt you for one second.
Yes.
I'm going to give the gentleman, Mike Catron, who's videotaping this, needs a change. We don't want to lose any importance.
So if you have any great evil stories, right, this is the time to tell them right now.
Let's all cuss.
Stan Lee is charging $50 for an autograph.
I think Jack would be appalled that Stan is charging $50 for an autograph unless Jack is getting $70. Thank you. Okay, Richard, I'm sorry.
Well, in any event, I talked to people about it, and I thought, there ought to be a story that was done in Jack's pencils, because he pencils so tightly and everything. And I didn't entirely approve of the work that was being done for him. And this is post-Mike. We're not talking about anything Mike did, because I think that he is the best of all of the Kirby interest. I really wanted to see what it would look like with modern printing technology to shoot Jack's pencils. And so anyway, I received the ink pot, and we went into a large kind of a common room there, sitting down, and everybody was talking, and by just sheer good fortune, well, I was seated across from me with Jack and Roz. And Jack reminisced a lot about when he was a boy, and I said to him, because I was going to publish a magazine that had not yet come out, but I was planning it. And I said, would you be interested in doing an 8 or 10 page story about your youth in the Bronx, just the way it was, without any artifice, without anything, just the way it was? And Jack had, it was curious, there was this expression of eagerness on his face, and I told him that I would pay him his current going rate, which I couldn't afford, but nonetheless. But anyway, there was this look of eagerness on his face, and he turned after a moment and approval, and she was emphatic about it. I mean, she really supported the idea. And so because of Roz, maybe Jack would have finally agreed, but Roz was the clincher. So we signed the contract, and I paid, the agreement was half up front and half when the book's completed. And or maybe it was just all up front. I really don't know, because I had great confidence in Jack. And but I was really had no experience with people that were on that level of the publishing world, and I just didn't know how closely they would meet deadlines and everything. Well, Jack and I agreed on 30 days, and 28 days later, the entire thing was in my hands, and it was just beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And it wouldn't have worked for superheroes or anything that was out of size, that particular technique. But for what Jack was doing, the story about his youth in the Bronx, an incident from his life in the Bronx, it was just really everything I wanted, and it was more. And I had only put a restriction of 10 pages, well, 8 or 10, Jack immediately took 10. But I only put that restriction on it because this was toward the tail, toward the end of Jack's very active career. And I was uncertain whether or not, because he was not quite doing the same things in some of the Pacific comics. He wasn't doing the breakdowns and layouts. Apparently that was just an experiment. But I gave him the 10 pages when I really wanted to give him 100 pages and put myself in hock for life. And so anyway, I got it, and I got the pages. I was just absolutely enamored of them, and there was an illness in my family. And I had to drop the plans for the magazine. And it was not until, if I'm not mistaken, it was 1991, I believe, wasn't it, Mark, that I was able to print it finally? It was
something.
It was a long time. It was a long time, but there was just no way I could do it. I couldn't. There was any way I could finance it. And Ross, when I finally published it, I did the ad and did everything, and I didn't say anything to the Kirbys about it. Until the first ads came out, and then I immediately told him that. And Ross said, Jack was reading the ad in the Comics Journal, and he said he thought it was a good ad. He thought it was the right kind of ad. And so then I said, you know, I've had this for all this time. She said, yes, we could have given this project to someone else. And they could have. I mean, here for 9 years or whatever it was, there was this really remarkable story by Jack that anybody could have taken. And but she said, you know, but we didn't do it. And so I said, well, because it's been all this time, I'm just going to pay you the original amount over again. And which I eventually did, but it was a difficult time. But it was this look of eagerness on Jack's face, just this extraordinary eagerness that you got. And then the kind of self-control of stopping there and turning to Roz, because she was his advisor, and she was just an extraordinary woman. You know, I don't have any more of a story there. It's not much of an anecdote in a way, but I think it tells you about Jack and Roz, and it also about their support of me during a very, very long time when they didn't have to. You know, 7 years have passed, and I at least, and the contract would surely be annulled by that, and I can't imagine anybody else that would do that. Nobody.
Anyway. Let's thank Richard Crowell for what I think is the last great movie story. tremendously for the book story. He loved that book story he had in Long Beach. He loved going down there and looking at what foreign publishers were doing.
Well, one of the, there was a man named Philippe Drier, who was a French artist, and his technique, the technical aspects of his technique weren't jazz. But his imagination was jazz. And there were two books about the adventures of Lone Sloan that came out, and in hardback, and that we carried, and Jack and Ross came in one day, and Jack was piling up all the books that he wanted because he just liked to look at the other artists, especially the European ones that are just being discovered then. And he says, "This is my kind of guy." And then I can't do the New York accent. I mean, if Mike can do it or something, we get to get Jack right, but it's that's my kind of guy. I just can't do it, but you get the idea. And so Philippe Drouet, who had a good reputation and sold very well in Europe and all that, nonetheless, he has a recommendation of Jack Kirby, and I don't think I could have hurt his sales one bit.
We got a few more minutes here, and I'm going to go take this a little bit longer. If you all promise me that when we finish, you'll leave and won't linger in the room and leave in front of the panel. Jonathan, we always ask people, what was the first Jack Kirby work they fell in love with? What did you get over in the UK?
We had very patchy distribution of Marvel and DC Comics in the UK for many years. In the early 70s, when Jack was at DC, DC came over more readily than Marvel. We used to get Marvel books out of these and we brought over as ballast on ships, so you would find them, but they'd be warped off from the water, which it kind of added to the charm. But I managed to get we used to have junk shops, I don't know what you call them over here, but second-hand shops where people would sell off their collections, and so I found some Kirby books there. First book I bought, I think it was either Fantastic Four 67 or 68, where him first appears. One of those, but it had a great big three in black felt tip running across the cover. They all had that. And I went, and I read it, blown away, but I went back and bought as many more of Marvel books that they had there as well. And the earliest that they had there, they had FF3 there with no cover, which I bought, and I still had that copy. And for many years, I thought that would be my retirement fund. I didn't know you needed the cover for it to be worth the money. But I still got that FF3. So it was the early Fantastic Four stuff, really, which I still think is, that for someone to have produced a run of that length and of that quality with no actual dips at all, you know, and still, towards the end, up to book 100, 101, still remarkable storytelling, remarkable character work, as well as remarkable design. That's a feat which, and I know we have you know, two of the greatest artists working at the moment. I mean, Walt Simonson's work on New Girls, one of the few artists I've who really did work with Jack's character, and all the Jack that they've had now, and also Eric's work, which is so informed by Jack, and all the that feels really much the same excitement I got from Jack's stuff, you know. But even so, I think very few people could achieve what Jack managed to do, and obviously he would stand and do credit for.
Are there any quick questions here from someone who's never asked, who hasn't asked anything before? Sir?
Hi, Mark. I just want to say thank you. I know it's a labor of love, and we're doing this panel every year.
Let's not talk about me. Let's talk about that.
Here's the question. I'm going to find out. The panel is described as some still hail as the king of comics, but this being the Captain America movie year and the 50th anniversary of Fantastic Four, why aren't there 40-foot posters of Jack's portrait hanging in there? And can I write next year's description?
You can write next year's description. I don't know. I try to always make this modest because, I can't say too much about this, but here's what happens now. If I, a fanzine, 28 years ago said, Jack usually ate cheeseburgers, I find myself in a deposition room with someone saying, are you sure he ate cheeseburgers and not hamburgers? Are you willing to swear on the oath here? I have to be real careful with my wording these days. Another question. Anybody else? Yes.
Question for Eric. I was wondering how what got you into Kirby, and what of Kirby's work did you kind of consciously bring into your own?
As much as I possibly could.
A particular aspect.
No, I mean just the the storytelling, to the design, to, I mean, kind of everything as much as possible, really. You know, I mean, every morning I wake up and look in the mirror and I'm a little disappointed that I don't see Jack Kirby. But the first work I saw of his was Candy.
Can I ask Mike a quick question?
Sure. Yes.
Mike, I've always been keen to know. You did some inking on what, I don't know if it was published, the Days of the Mob 2. The black and white work that Kirby was doing when he was at
the entirety of Days of the Mob 2.
Yeah, was that published Days of the Mob 2?
No.
Well, when it was printed in one of those DC House fanzines, they redid all of my lettering. But I got some very nice compliments from Richard when I inked that, because my whole mindset was the Kirby that I grew up with as a kid, the Boys Ranch and the Bullseye and all that stuff. And it was like, I'm doing Simon and Kirby.
Yeah. Cool. But I could see, I always felt that was tough. You know, we took my Street Code when he was back doing the gangster stuff. I thought that was something, obviously, that Jack, you know, because a lot of the things he saw on the street, the understanding formed his work, a lot of his time in the army. And I wonder whether, because he was working black and white, because that was 1.5 size up, and I've seen some of the earlier work. I know the unpublished Soul Love book, that was twice up, the artwork for that.
It was 11 by 15, not 10 by 15.
Oh, so it was slightly bigger. And I think, you know, even though we never saw that published, actually Vince did do a lovely job on some of that. I mean, it was actually some of that was lovely art, really.
Vince did a better job before it was, they went back to him, he inked the book, and he gave it back to him and said, make the men look more like, remember Steve, you remember this? Make the men look more like Sidney Poitier and women look more like Diane Carroll.
Yeah, you can see they try to make them more Caucasian.
Yeah, and if you see the originals, they're online in various places, you'll see an awful lot of white out of the faces.
Yeah.
That's obliterating not only Jack's work, but Vince's as well. He was kind of victimized.
I loved his work in Days of the Mob.
Yeah.
I didn't care what Jack drew. No matter what it was, there was just this incredible power and strength. Let me tell you how intimidating it was in the old days of special delivery. For me to open a package from Jack, and the first thing was to be engulfed with the aroma of Roy Tan cigars. And then to look at those pages and go, God, this is great, and gee, don't screw it up.
Did he want to work with Washtenaw, or did he think about having more texture? Because I wonder just the possibility of it being printed in magazine. I think it was still the pulpy paper. It wasn't like modern stuff. But Wallen books at the time, obviously, and I guess Jack might have been influenced by that or inspired by that in his own way, because they were, and they had a lot of wash work, a lot of tone work in there. Well, I wonder, did he intend that in the pencils, or did he?
Well, Mark could probably tell you about the aborted Kirby Comics project. That's what Galaxy Green pages were done for.
Well, I have taken a lot of time here, unfortunately, so we'll have to continue this in another case here. I'm going to ask everybody, as we finish here, as I thank everybody, would you please, instead of coming up to the stage, would you please just leave the room so that the next panel can get in here and they don't yell at me and give me less time next year? Would you join me in thanking Mr. Eric Norman?